Welcome to Inside Analog Photography Radio Program. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is all about traditional process photography. We talk about instant photography. We talk about black and white. We talk about color film. We talk about dry plate, wet plate, you name it, alternate printing processes, everything going on in analog photography. And of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is brought to you by Fujifilm over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. They have beautiful C41 color neg, black and white, color chrome, and of course, instant. Instant film rocks. These guys have so much great things going on right now with instant film. Of course, they have the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4.5. Color, black and white, high speed black and white, but you know what's even cooler? They have the Instax cameras and film. The Instax Wide is in the country, available everywhere. And of course, right now, brand new, the Instax Mini is now in the U.S. They have cameras. They have film. This Instax Mini is 2.5 by 3.5. It's the size of a business card. This is really fun stuff. You got to check it out. www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all your film to get developed, proofs, you name it. They got a great workflow going. www.richardphotolab.com. DR5 for the most unbelievable proprietary process to turn your black and white film into positives, into chrome. You won't believe until you get your film back as a piece of chrome will blow your mind. The dynamic range, the latitude, it's just unbelievable stuff. Definitely check it out. www.dr5.com. Iger Studios, Lenny Iger, the place to have high-resolution scans done. You know, a lot of people now are shooting analog. They're using a high-resolution scan. They're making digital negatives on an inkjet. Or maybe they're going straight to an inkjet output, but they're making digital negatives and they're printing contact prints. They're doing all the stuff you need to get a high-resolution scan. They're using an Aztec Premier, 8,000 PPI, adjustable aperture. They can give you scans that are basically grain-free. They can adjust it for every kind of film out there. This is crazy stuff going on with Lenny Iger and the guys at Iger Studios. Check them out, igerstudios.com. And, of course, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. The camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder. Our media partners, www.apug.org, the Analog Photography User Group, the place on the web for all things analog process. This is a great place to learn, to share information, to get tips and tricks. The community for analog photography, www.apug.org. And of course, our photographic philanthropy partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, www.geh.org. The place to go to find out about the history of traditional analog photography. These people are keeping this alive. They have over 7,000 cameras in the museum of everything that's ever been made, including the Hasselblads that were shot on the moon. You name it. They have the collection. This is a great way to help support. You can be a member of George Eastman House organization. They have a lot of great things going on, but this is something you can do to help give back to photography, to help keep traditional analog photography alive for generations to come. Definitely check them out, www.geh.org. Today on Inside Analog Photography, we're going to have with us Wayne Martin Belger. Wayne is a pinhole photographer, an artist, a machinist, and an all-around cool guy. He makes these unbelievable cameras out of skulls, out of billet aluminum, magnesium, copper, jewels. I mean, this stuff is unbelievable. Shooting large format pinhole photography. This is great stuff. Wayne, how you doing today?
Good. You?
Good. Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. Great to have you on the program and just to talk to you today about your beautiful art and your cameras and all the stuff you're doing.
And also, thanks for what you're doing for analog photography.
Oh, thank you.
It's good to see it.
So, Wayne, tell us about yourself. I know that you make these beautiful, one-off, handcrafted machine pieces of art that are just over-the-top, very cool. But let's talk about how Wayne got into photography to start with.
Well, actually, I started with doing assemblage art. I mean, pretty much since I was a fetus. My parents remember me being in the backyard just constructing large, pretty much, installations, or even in my bedroom. And I've just always kind of done that. But what I've done in the past is I used to make these installations that were dedicated to a subject that I wanted to learn about. A few years back, I had my friend who is a professional photographer in Los Angeles, and he was doing a series with pinhole photography. And so what he did, he was using a foam core box, and it was really shaky and just wasn't working well. And I think it was for a shoot for Nissan or something. So I just made him a camera in the same way that I did the rest of my installations, which was a camera that was dedicated to a subject. So I was trained as a machinist at that time. So I machined it out of aluminum, but what he didn't expect was it had insects crawling in and out of pinholes or out of holes in the side of the camera. It had windows on it. It had Pablo Neruda poem that was etched in the aircraft aluminum going around the camera. So it became an art piece within itself. And then I just kind of fell in love with pinhole photography at that point, just like the process of just pure light and time coming through a small hole, through a really small aperture. And I like the fact that the air that touches my subject could actually touch the film. So there's nothing being altered, basically, just pure light and time and space. So I guess that was my biggest fascination with it. And since I was never taught or I've had a lesson or anything in photography, nobody really told me what was wrong or right to do. So to me, the camera was just as important as the photos. And if I'm going to be into a subject and take a photo of the subject, it made sense to me to make basically a shrine or something that's involved with the subject I want to photograph. So there it is in a nutshell, kind of what I do.
Wow, so really no, like you said, formal basic photographic training. It was like you're a machinist, your buddy's making something. It's like, dude, this is garbage, and I'm going to make you one.
Pretty much, yeah. But also I paint, and I do installation art. So, I mean, it came from that. And then I kind of fell in love with pinhole photography, so I kind of moved my installation art into the cameras, which just made perfect sense to me. And when you look at the whole evolution of it from when I was really, really little till now, it just makes sense to me. And like I said, too, is as far as my darkroom techniques, the camera techniques, the way I set them up, I've never had anybody show me anything. It's just been all trial and error. So I just kind of came up with this process that I really enjoy, and it works well for me.
So let's talk about your first camera you made that was a commercial piece that you actually made to be sold. How does the whole process work when you come up with a thought for a design or a theme, a genre for a camera? Because you've made different ones that we'll talk about. The wood camera, the deer camera, the classic camera. I mean, you made all kinds of stuff. Really, really cool. So how does this come about? Is it people that are saying, Wayne, can you build me a camera that's themed around a deer? Or do you just come up with stuff and then that's how it goes?
No, it's just stuff I come up with, stuff I want to learn about. The first cameras, I just completely made for myself because I was falling in love with the idea of pinhole photography and I just really fell in love with a dark room. I never thought about actually ever showing them in a gallery or selling anything. Yeah, they're just strictly for me. And then I started getting this feeling that there's a subject I want to learn about. This camera then became a bridge between me and the subject, and I could be more involved with the subject. And so I saw it as more of a bridge. I never really saw it as my profession. I never thought it would be what I ended up doing full-time. Some of the early cameras, like I made one that I started photographing kids with. It's called Dragonfly. It was a really personal piece. I used to do some work for child recovery. An organization would send me to different cities if there was a child that was missing and there was a sighting. I'd worked with different families, but I worked with this one family and got really close with them. Their daughter was actually found dead about a year after I started working with them. So the Dragonfly camera is actually a shrine or an altar to her. And with that, I photograph moments of children's lives. So it's basically a lot of my own working out my own issues almost, or things that I want to learn about myself. I'd create a piece around it, which was a lot of my assemblage art when I was a lot younger, too. So it just kind of evolved into that. So that's kind of where it all comes from. Now, as far as selling stuff, I had a friend who had a space in the brewery in downtown. She had a little gallery space, and she fell in love with my cameras. And she said, would you mind on the next art walk if we could have a little show with your work and put them out there? I was like, sure, fine. And people really freaked out over them. So that was kind of like, well, maybe I could kind of go this direction. Also, all the ideas are pretty much really personal ideas, things I want to learn about myself, things I want to learn about life in general. I've never had anybody come up and go, hey, could you make me a camera for this and that? I've never done a commission. So it's been all strictly really personal work.
Let's pick a camera and talk about its design and sort of how this process sort of goes. So let's talk about, I guess, the Yama.
Okay. My ex-wife, actually, she was from India. So we'd go to India and we'd spend some time in India. One of the things that really struck me is a lot of the Tibetan refugee areas, it's huge masses of people of refugees. And here in the United States, you really don't get that idea of refugee or of people having to leave their home. So that's kind of what it was inspired by. Because you see a lot of Tibetan arts and just cities exist due to mass exodus. We really don't get that here. So that was more of a study of that. I came across a skull, it was from Beijing. And there was a whole bunch of Tibetan artifacts that were all laid out. I have a friend in San Francisco who works for a Tibetan legal organization. He's actually a Tibetan refugee himself. He was a Tibetan Lama. And I told him about the project idea that I had as far as making a camera out of this human skull that was a Tibetan Lama skull. It estimated was about 500 years old, the skull itself, and it was from a monastery in Tibet. So I told my friend Tashi about it. He goes, I think it's a great project. Bring a lot of awareness to the Tibetan issue. It'll bring a lot of awareness to Americans or Westerners about Exodus in a fine art setting, a little more of aggressive fine art setting. So I asked about the skull. He goes, well, as far as the skull itself, I really care less because it had the same relevance as a bird flying over and losing a feather. In the Tibetan Buddhist view, is a person's gone. It has no relevance whatsoever. But he did like the fact that the main project for this camera is going back to Dharamsala, India.
Yeah.
Where he's set up photo shoots for me. And I'm doing a 500-year-old homecoming of a 500-year-old Tibetan Lama through his eyes and photographing Exodus through his own eyes. It was really pretty interesting, too. After that, a bunch of science blogs kind of caught on to that. There was a lot of stuff written about how this camera is actually more true representation of what's going on in the human mind than a PET scan. Because they're saying that this actually shows real pure creativity, shows what's inside the mind rather than PET scans, electrical impulses. And it is. It's kind of the first time somebody is able to see through somebody else's eyes. Because it's working exactly like the iris in the human eye. It's an upside down, backwards image that's created inside the skull. But this in case on film. And actually, you could slide in the back of the skull a little plate that has a finished photograph on it. It turns on two lights, and you look through two viewers in the back of the skull, and you see a 3D image of what the skull saw in his optical department of the skull. So something different.
Wow, very cool.
And also, the actual installation, it's quite a huge installation. I mean, Yama, the camera, or the skull itself. Also, that's another thing, is in Tibetan Buddhism, Yama is the Tibetan god of death. And he's in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and he's in the third house. What happens is when you die, you go through the first house, and then the second house, you have the Tibetan God of Death, who basically has seen all of your life. He's viewed every detail of your life. And he drops a white stone for good deeds and a black stone for bad deeds. So it's kind of like a tally of your life. And then you go in the third house, which depends on how many white stones and black stones you have, is where you're reincarnated. And since this is the first time somebody's seen past death, I guess, that's why I named him Yama. Plus, I've done a lot of study as far as, like in schools, doing comparative religions and stuff, so I've always found a lot of the folklore behind that really fascinating.
No, I think it is extremely fascinating. I think the camera itself is exquisite. How long did it take you to make that?
That was about a year and a half. I got the skull, and then I sent it to Tashi in San Francisco. He had it blessed by a Tibetan Lama for its current journey. In the whole installation piece, he's on this big table, but there's this white prayer cloth that's under him that the Tibetan Lama blessed and then wrapped up the skull and sent it back to me. Yeah, that's about a year and a half. There's a lot of really intricate parts from me in the piece. I start with just big chunks of aluminum or copper, and I mill out by hand every piece for the camera. That one got really pretty intricate. Because actually, it's pneumatic, too. There's two pneumatic pistons inside with a 300 PSI air tank inside the camera itself and a toggle switch underneath the jaw. And you flip the toggle switch, the two pneumatic pistons separate the skull into two, and you can load the 4x5 film sideways into the camera. And then a divider goes down the middle of the camera and inside between the two eyes that creates two side-by-side images on one sheet of 4x5 film.
So it's almost like a stereo image.
It is a stereo image, yeah.
Wow. So the pinhole orifices are identical on both eyes, so you're making a stereo, true to life, what the skull sees, basically.
Correct. Yeah. That's exactly it.
Now, when you were making Yama or any of these other cameras, do you sit down and say, okay, well, I'm going to start drawing a rough concept, or is it just like, well, I got some rough dimensions, let's just go start whittling?
I don't start with any drawings whatsoever. Generally, I start with an idea, and then I start getting involved with a subject that I want to learn about. As I'm studying the subject and being involved with a subject, I start collecting artifacts from that subject. Like with Yama, first it was a trip to India and actually seeing mass exodus. So then I ended up with like different things from Tibetan Buddhism. Like on Yama, on the side of them, there's these beads. They're counter beads from Tibetan malas that are quite old. And those are hanging on the side. And there's turquoise from Tibet. And there's different things I collected before I even got the skull or started with the camera. So first, it's being involved with the camera. When I'm actually making it, I don't have a CNC mill or lathe. It's all hand done. So I'm turning cranks when I'm making each piece, but I don't have any drawings. I look at it more like painting. When you sit down, you're painting, you're just kind of working oil paints. You're working with the paints and just working it. I do the same thing. I chuck up a piece of aluminum. Generally, it's a piece of a forged aircraft aluminum. And I just start milling it out by hand and take a lot of measurements. I have a lot of measuring equipment because a lot of my tolerances are usually kept within about a thousandth of an inch so that there's no light leaks or anything. And I think that's what a lot of my collectors really like. There isn't any drawings. Just kind of go with a flow and whatever's needed, and I kind of feel the piece as it's starting to come out and then create the camera around it. I do the same thing in the darkroom with my prints. I have a bunch of my negs that I developed, and I start working in the darkroom, and then I'll go through 150 sheets of paper before I find the right combination of what I start to like. But I just really like that organic flow between me, the metal, the piece, and the subject. It works really well with me.
Let's say we're going to do a camera and you're going to do a new project. Is it like I know that I need these mechanical dimensions to fit film said holder and you work from that center out? Or how would you actually conceptually work on a project based off of the object itself that you're going to start with or the theme? Or is it all center off of, well, I know I need this distance from film plane to pinhole orifice and then you work out? How's that work?
It all starts with a subject. It all starts with learning. I'm kind of a book freak. And I really get into different books, I get into the subject, and I really start creating. Like, project I'm working on right now, the camera's getting really, really intense for this project. Through mythology, I've always loved the mythology of creation and destruction. Always been fascinated by it. I mean, from Shiva to Oppenheimer. You start studying these different objects of mythology to scientists like Oppenheimer, and getting more and more involved into it. And then you start visualizing what direction you'd like to go with it. I ended up making a connection, and this woman's actually working with me on the project. She works at the Stanford Particle Accelerator, and started having this visualization of how I wanted to study creation and destruction by using a particle accelerator. So talking to her, we've done some tests. We actually took the Hindu god Shiva, which he's the god of creation and destruction in Hinduism, to the particle accelerator and shot him with a beam from it and used Polaroid X-ray film to see how much scatter we could get off bronze, and then platinum, and then different materials. So the camera right now that I'm building, it's going to be about 250 individual parts that I've made so far for it. It's going to be an 8x10 X-ray camera that is pneumatic also, but all the walls of the camera are all see-through. They're all half-inch thick lead glass that they use for X-ray rooms.
Wow.
And it's completely see-through. It has a tungsten pinhole. When you hit a switch underneath, because it needs to be completely enclosed in lead, the film itself, you hit a switch underneath, it separates by 6 inches, like two glass clamshells opening up. And then another piece rises up out that is a film holder, and then counterweights go down below. Things are going every which direction. And I love just the mechanics of it. I get really passionate about function. So then you put the 8x10 film in, hit the switch again, and it's completely enclosed in lead at that point, lead and tungsten. And then what we're doing is the particle accelerator in Palo Alto is a 240-meter accelerator that gets particles traveling at 999.9% the speed of light, and at one point it sheds off 17,400 electron volts of X-ray radiation. Through that radiation coming off there, we're focusing it through an 8-micron beam, and I'm shooting icons of creation to destruction with that beam, and then the impact and the scatter of the photons will be picked up by my camera and produce an actual image from the impact of the subject that I'm shooting.
Wow.
So it's using atomic particles in a device that was actually designed and created to understand how to make a switch for the first nuclear bomb to study the mythology of creation and destruction. So the whole thing came from just my fascination with mythology and evolved from there into this gigantic monster project.
How long have you been working on the nuclear camera? What's the name of this project? Do you name the stuff when it's done, or do you name your projects and the cameras when they're finished?
I named this one Shiva. He's one of the most prominent figures in the mythology of creation and destruction. Oppenheimer even had a quote from Shiva, from the Gita, after the first nuke was set off. So that one's called Shiva. A lot of the names of the projects are pretty basic. You could kind of see a lot of the roots, like Yama was the god of death in Tibetan Buddhism. The camera that has HIV-positive blood in it, that one's called Untouchable because one of my best friends came down with HIV. This is like about 15 years ago. Him telling me his experience with what was happening with him, he reminded me of the Untouchables in India, when I was in India. And so that one's named Untouchable. So a lot of the names do relate to the subject it's dedicated to.
Let's talk about the HIV camera. This is a very interesting piece. You're actually using blood as a filter.
Yeah. The camera's pretty intricate. For one thing, I want it to be completely enclosed and safe. That has about 170 different parts in it that I machined out. The only parts I didn't make are these aircraft fittings that are on the front. I got a good connection with the aerospace industry. So I think they hold like 30,000 PSI or something like that. So I didn't make those parts. But like I said, this camera was inspired by one of my best friends who told me he was HIV positive. And just working with him and seeing what experiences he's been going through, that's how it came about. So the camera itself, it has these two clear acrylic cylinders on each side of the camera. On one side, there's a pump that I made. There's a piston inside the cylinder, and then a pump that I made out of rare earth magnet. You could actually pump the blood through the camera. So the camera itself has its own circulatory system. So the blood goes through. It goes in front of a pinhole through a shim, two pieces of acrylic that are 5/1000ths of an inch apart, and you shoot through that. So all the images through it are seen through the blood itself, and they're actually toned by the blood itself. Also, to get the right combination, because the blood's mixed with other things. The blood's mixed with sodium chloride 9% and heparin. Heparin's an anticoagulant, and the sodium chloride 9% is actually the closest thing to your own body's natural fluid. So what I did is I had to test before I wanted to take my friend's blood and put it in the camera itself. So I have a friend who's a midwife, and she took a bunch of vials of blood from me so I could test with my own blood. And I found that with a certain combination of heparin and sodium chloride, and with my blood between two sheets of glass that are 5/1000ths of an inch apart, it had the same restriction. It had the same light restriction as a number 25 red filter. So the blood itself is my number 25 red filter to give more contrast to the images. And one thing the midwife knew, too, is I'm quite anal or fanatic about things I do, if you couldn't tell by the cameras. And I had to get the right combination of blood down to get the right light restriction, the right combination. So I had the midwife take a certain number of vials. And at one point when she was taking my blood, she said, "Are you okay?" And I looked at her and I said, "My ears are really warm and I feel funny." And all of a sudden I was on the floor. But she knew I would be a little upset if she didn't get all the vials. So she took another four vials from me while I was passed out on the floor. So ended up getting the right amount of blood down. I spun it out, pulled the right red blood cells, you know, mixed the combinations, figured it all out. And then we took my friend's blood and I mixed it, put it in the camera. And it's been a pretty amazing project. And I just, with that camera, photographed people with HIV and AIDS, and that's all the people I'll shoot with it. And I've shot about 15 guys in San Francisco so far that are HIV positive or have AIDS. The main thing I want to do with the project is take it worldwide. I want to do a geographic comparison of people with HIV and AIDS worldwide and how geographic location makes all the difference in your survival. Like when I was in India, you'd see people with AIDS that had HIV for like a year, and they're pretty much on the way out, because there's no access to drugs whatsoever. That was kind of another thing, too, is just the pharmaceutical companies, their personal interests have such an influence on the survival of people in other countries.
Well, sure, and it's all based off of economic currency and money, and if you don't have money, then you die.
Yeah, that's pretty much the focus of the project. And when you look at the images, they look really beautiful, whether it's somebody who is on all the medications, and they're like 6 foot, 230 pounds because they're working out all the time, or they're 6 foot and close to 100 pounds because they're about to die. It's just kind of an interesting way to present the situation. Like I said, too, it's another really personal project because I'm one of my best friends. He's one of the guys on the medication. He's lucky. He's 6'4", and he's probably about 240 and just really healthy. But then, like I said, spending a bunch of time in India is just such a different story. And I want to go to Calcutta with the camera and do a photo shoot there. And also I have a connection in Uganda to continue the series there, too.
How long does the blood stay in the camera?
The most I've been able to have it was about 8 months. It gets kind of goopy after a little while, even with the anticoagulants and everything else. And I'm starting to wonder if it's because of my rare earth magnet and iron in the blood itself, because I could have it in another jar, and in the jar itself, it'll be perfectly fine for like a long time. But in the camera itself, it's been going away after a few months.
How do you flush this and sterilize it and keep this all okay for yourself when you're operating? Because I'm sure no one else operates this camera.
Nah, it's just me. Even with all my collectors that have bought the cameras, nobody's ever used them. It's basically people collecting them who are collecting an investment. People who collect fine art have been buying them. Well, first of all, the blood itself, after a few hours out of the body, the virus is dead anyways. Another thing, too, is the amount of heparin that's used in it. Pretty much nothing could live through that anyway, also. So it's pretty non-toxic. At one point, I was contemplating mixing the blood with potassium cyanide because the cyanide will help remove oxygen from the blood so that the blood wouldn't oxidize.
Right.
And while it takes out the blood, it turns it like an orangish-red color, so I'd still have my color tone. But the idea of shipping potassium cyanide all over the place didn't really thrill me.
No.
I have enough trouble trying to ship human heads and everything else.
Yeah, that's a good thing you bring up. I mean, probably it's not a problem here. Is it a problem in other countries? I mean, what's the issue with shipping dead human remains?
It's been fine so far, I think, because fine art kind of fits into a whole other realm. The galleries I work with, they have customs agents who go there and they kind of work with them. The other thing I do, too, is I've been taking the cameras themselves. If I have a show, I'll ship the installations, all the photos and all the frames and everything else to the gallery. But then the cameras themselves I have in Pelican cases that I fly with myself. Because sometimes it just takes a little bit more explanation. And I get to the airport at least 2 hours ahead of time. Because I know when I'm checking in my bags, there's going to be a few questions. Usually every time I get to the airport, it's like, nope, I'm sure it'll be fine. It's just art. And then all of a sudden I get a page. Would Mr. Belger please come to the baggage area? Because sometimes there could be two human heads, a human heart, the circulatory system with blood in it, mercury. There's a whole bunch of different things that pull up a lot of questions. And then usually the customs guys end up just digging it. On top of the cases, I have a bunch of my magazines I've been in because my work's been published quite a bit.
Right.
I'll open up the magazines and they're like, oh, that's that? That's really cool. And all of a sudden they're all happy, free drink coupons and everything else.
Wow, how cool.
It's been interesting.
So let's talk about acquisition if you want to get one of your cameras. How do people go about this? What do these things cost? How does this work?
The cost-wise, they're all over the place. It depends on the piece. They range right now from about $18,000 to $240,000 per piece. But what that comes with, too, is the whole entire installation. It's anywhere from 3 to 8 mounted framed photographs. And it comes with a wall mounting system or a floor mounting system, and everything in the whole entire installation comes with it. Like Yama was just shipped to Toronto, I think 2 weeks ago, because there's a collector, it looks like he's going to buy. Yama's the $240,000 camera right now. But he was just shipped to Toronto with my pretty big-time collectors. Check him out. Also, what's interesting, too, is my collectors love is I have a deal with my collectors. Whenever they buy one of my cameras, they have to sign a contract that says I get to take it back whenever I feel like to work on the project. Because I didn't make the camera just to be used once or for a few photographs. I want to keep on learning. I made these things so I could learn things, and I want to keep on going with the project. So what I have is this contract that says I could take it back when I want to work on the project, but from now on, the owner of the camera to go with me on the photo shoot if they wish, and also they'll get the #2 print from anything I decide to print for free. There's a collector in San Francisco, his name is Justin. Actually, he owns 3 art galleries and a publishing company. He owns the underwater camera, which I think is one of the first 4x5 underwater cameras that really worked. As far as pinhole, he owns that camera, and he's been on, I think, 3 scuba dives with me using that camera. Also, he's received, like, over 30 photos. I think there are 30 by 34 color prints from photo shoots from that camera. And those go for about $2,800 each for the photos. And they come in a series of 10, but he gets all the #2s from now on for free. I've been doing a photo series with that camera in public aquariums. I did a photo shoot in the Monterey Bay Aquarium. That just came out beautiful. I did in their kelp forest exhibit, and actually it's been a year now. I did a photo shoot at Scripps Aquarium in San Diego. It's pretty fun because I scuba dive with the camera. They make a big event out of it. I have a regulator that has a microphone in it, and then there's a docent in the audience. I could talk to the crowd and tell them what I'm doing while I'm in the aquarium. It ends up being a pretty cool little thing. Right now I have 2 cameras. I have the Sons of Abraham camera, which is a 9/11 camera, and also the deer camera, which were paid for by collectors quite some time ago. But I still have the cameras because they want me to use them. Because occasionally they just get prints sent to them whenever I use it.
So that is very cool that, like you said, you buy this piece of art, this installation, this camera, but the iteration of it lives on. You keep continuing to do projects with these. Are you working with every camera you've made?
Yeah. I mean, I still use cameras from 2002 pretty consistently. I have a roadside altar camera going to be getting back pretty soon because I've been working on a roadside altar series, and I've noticed a bunch of new ones around. So that's being sent to me. I've shot about 200 roadside altars all over the world, and it's a pretty interesting series. Another thing that's been really cool, too, is rather than just going and buying a painting or a sculpture, the collectors are kind of liking the fact that they have this ongoing relationship with the artist. If I'm in town, I come by and I see him, and maybe I'll use the camera while I'm in town. Or, like I said, they could go with me on photo shoots, which is quite a different thing. It's like having some big painter, you sit there with him while he's working on your painting or something.
Right.
And also what's cool, too, is rather than just buying a painting, you're still getting more and more work as time goes on, which has been fun. It wasn't that long ago I sent a whole series of photos to the guy who owns the underwater camera, and he was just pretty jazzed to the fact that he's still getting work for free.
No, that is very cool. How many cameras have you made so far?
I don't even know. I think 12 or 13, and I got 3 more under construction right now.
And do you find that they keep getting more and more complex, or are you still doing ones that are like, oh, here's a simple little design, this is my idea for this, and you can just crank one out? Or has everyone turned into a multi-year extravaganza of machining and thought process and the whole deal making it?
It's the whole deal now. I seem to get more and more enjoyment out of getting deeper and deeper. If you're going to get into something, go down the rabbit hole as far as you could go. So that's kind of what I've been doing. The projects are getting more and more intense. I have more and more the ability to really kind of travel and just make these projects bigger vision than what they were before. Yeah, they're getting far more intense than they ever have been, and I'm enjoying it more. I'm allowed to go down my little rabbit hole more and more. I seem to disappear at times, but I'm enjoying it quite a bit.
That is cool, though. I mean, you know, everybody needs to disappear.
Yeah, if people would do that more, there'd be a lot fewer major issues in the world.
Yeah. Let's talk about your photography. What are you using to capture these beautiful images on? What are you using for film?
Primarily 4x5 film. It varies quite a bit. I used to be a bit of a Kodak guy, but I've kind of been switching over to Fuji quite a bit. Fuji's been good to me lately. They sent me a bunch of Polaroid, or their version of Polaroid. Because I about panicked, because I used Polaroid film for my setups. Because all my cameras will take Polaroid backs, and so I do a bunch of my test shots with Polaroid film. And also I love, which I hope Fuji makes in the future, Type 55 that produces a negative. Because I kind of had this really cool special process with the Type 55 film, where I would shoot a bunch of images using it, and then I would take the negative, and I wouldn't clean it, and I'd throw it in a box for 3 months. And over 3 months, it would just start getting these weird cracks on it, and these weird, like, just natural things would start happening to the negative. And then I would go into the dark room and just start working with it. Just kind of like that whole natural erosion process to the negative. It's been pretty fun. So hopefully Fuji will make that in the future. But it's been a lot of Fuji lately, especially with the color shots. I haven't played much of the black and white yet, but from what I hear, Fuji's going to be sending me some film to play with. So that'll be cool. And then now I'm using 8x10 X-ray film, too. So that's a whole new thing also.
Now, have you had a chance to play with any X-ray capture yet, or are you going to wait till the camera's completely done and do all this at the accelerator?
Well, I did 2 tests so far at the accelerator, but I used X-ray Polaroid film just to see what kind of levels of photon scatter I was getting from the impact. All my results came out really, really positive. So that's going to determine the focal length and the aperture of the tungsten pinhole. And then just kind of go with that. I'm going to have about a week to play with the accelerator. I mean, what a big toy to play with.
Yeah.
What I'd love to do, though, with that project, too, is go around the world to different accelerators, study the local mythology of creation and destruction, and then shoot the icons of creation and destruction that are the local icons. There's one piece that's going to be in the camera. In the back, it's like 2 glass trapezoids that come together.
Yeah.
In the back trapezoid is a bonsai tree. So it looks like a little greenhouse kind of thing.
Right.
But the glass that's in the back trapezoid isn't lead. And the bonsai tree will be growing in dirt from Hiroshima. You could actually flip around the tree. So that's going to receive some pretty good-sized doses of radiation when it's in the back of the camera. But then also that tree could flip around inside the front of the camera. So the photons that are coming through the tungsten pinhole, the bonsai tree will be impacted before the film while it's inside the camera, so it'll leave a silhouette of this tree.
Sure goes great with the theme of the camera, though.
Oh, it does. There's another really cool piece, too. The part that comes up out of the camera, that's the film holder that rises up high, it has a piece of carbonaceous chondrite in it, which is a piece of meteorite they found in northern Africa. And it's a piece of meteorite that was formed before our solar system or before our sun was even formed. So for a camera about creation and destruction, I thought that was kind of a cool little figurehead piece that rises up out of the camera when it opens.
No, that is cool. Let's talk about here, Wayne, where people can actually go see some installations, your website, images. If you're out giving talks, I mean, where can they see what's going on with this beautiful art you're doing and these unique creations and all the cool stuff you're up to?
Well, it's my website, which is boyofblue.com. It's going to be going through a major overhaul. We're putting a bunch of flash in it and everything else. So it's going to be even cooler looking, and I'm going to have a little page for stuff that's being made right now. Also, at the end of November, I'll be in Art 21 in Cologne, Germany with some of my work. It's a big art festival thing where they have artists from all over the world. And then in December, in a gallery show at Strychnine Gallery called The Magistrates in Berlin, I'll be there, then Toronto in January. So it's like three shows right after each other. It's going to be a little nutty then. Big show that's going to be coming up will be in Toronto at a gallery called the Meta Gallery. It's a big solo show, and I'm going to have three new cameras that have never been seen in it. The particle accelerator camera will be there with images from it, including a trilogy of the cameras that were made out of human skulls that represent birth, life, and death. The show opens April 30th. Also, what's going to be really neat about that time is that there is a really big photography festival that goes on in Toronto for that entire month in May. So I'll be doing different lectures there. I'll be doing different shoots, and there'll be quite a bit going on. The photography festival is called Contact, and it's supposed to be a pretty big ordeal in Toronto. People come from all over the world for this photography festival. So I'll be doing quite a bit for that, and the show will be up for like a month and a half with all the latest stuff. Then cool. Back to Europe.
Do you find that you have more draw and interest in your artwork and your cameras and everything that you're doing in Europe than you do here in the States?
Especially since the economy kind of crashed. My website, I mean, in the last years, had over 20 million hits. Within that, I mean, the majority of them are still in the United States. But then Germany and France is pretty close behind. Lately, it seems like the Eastern Bloc has been really into my work. I just came out in a magazine called Top Class. They did a big feature story. It's from the Czech Republic. And then in October, Popular Mechanics is doing a huge feature story. Popular Mechanics in Moscow is doing a really big feature story. I mean, they have like 60 different images of my work, and it's kind of wild.
No, it's great coverage, though. I mean, I think it's really cool to see the more people that can see your artwork, even more so, even if you're into machine technologies and just the craft of making this stuff out of metal and machining things and all these mechanical devices that are in it. So there's different levels of complexity to the work to where it's like you can go for it from an artistic standpoint. You can look at it from just a raw machine technology engineering standpoint. It's pretty cool.
Like I said earlier, I mean, it seems to just go across the board, and I think it's because I'm just doing my own thing. I didn't really think about an art career or a photography career or a career in any kind of sciences. Before this, I was a musician, and it's just kind of evolved into this thing, but it's what I like to do, which is my own thing. I don't know if I told you about this earlier, but there's this great blog. It's just called Science Blog. But yeah, it was the woman who was saying that my cameras were a representation of a scan of the brain and that they pick up true creativity rather than just electrical impulses. And they really went off it, and then people would comment on the blog and went back and forth, and all these hardcore science people were just like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. It was pretty fun. That's another thing that's been kind of great, too, is actually stepping into the science realm, because the particle accelerator, they're spending most of their time zapping mind tailings to get spectrum readings. And it's just kind of the same thing. So all of a sudden this artist comes in with this wacky idea, and they just really seem to dig it. Last year at Scripps, they were just bending over backwards to really have me shoot there, and they were just so excited. They gave me this whole staff of people to work with. This guy who made a pinhole camera. Scripps is one of the biggest institutions of oceanography in the world. It was just really something to see how excited they were getting, because it was something different. It wasn't studying the mating habits of the Garibaldi. It was something completely different.
Yeah, they love different stuff, and I think this is just very unique, and it's just so cool to see that you're spending your time to crank out this beautiful art. Everything's themed, and there's a meaning to it, and it's just deeper than, wow, look at that cool machine camera.
Like I said, it's all about the subject. I wouldn't survive as a regular photographer. Within my life, I've never wanted to be a voyeur. I've never wanted to stand back and just take images. I want to participate in basically everything. That's kind of why I guess I got into this, or why I'm finding this is a good bridge to learn about things. So that I could just be involved more with life, I guess. And it's a process that works really well for me.
No, it sounds like you are enjoying yourself and life is good.
Oh, quite a bit. Kind of nice when you get some interesting, wacky idea, and then you start really getting into it. Then you present that idea to Scripps Aquarium or something, and they're like, we would love to have you. And then all of a sudden you get to go on these adventures, and you get to learn. That's been one of my biggest addictions ever, has just been learning. This gives me even more of an opportunity to do that. I guess I'm quite self-centered in a way because I'm going off on things I really want to learn about. But at the same time, I get thousands of emails from people that are incredibly touched by different projects, from Sons of Abraham, which is the 9/11 camera, to the HIV camera, to Dragonfly. I find a lot of inspiration. I did a lecture at an art college in Ohio in February, and part of the lecture was just don't go to college, which I'm sure the school didn't really like. But it wasn't just don't go to college. It was art schools are great if you want to learn advertising techniques or more commercial photography and stuff like that. I said that what you need to learn to do is go down your rabbit hole. It was kind of an interesting lecture. I had fun with it.
So, Wayne, tell me, what do you do for a hobby? I mean, you're machining parts, you're out doing photography, you're coming up with these cool themes, you're researching things, you get to go dive in at Script, you're out hanging out with the guys at Stanford Accelerator. I mean, you got a lot of cool stuff going. What do you do for fun?
I mean, that is my fun. I mean, I've been a mountain climber and rock climber for over 20 years. So I do spend a lot of time on rocks. I specialize in something called big wall, which is multiple day ascents up vertical walls. So I spend maybe 2 weeks on the side of El Cap. It depends on the route. So that's always been one of my biggest passions. Still do quite a bit of scuba diving and just like to be out. What I'm doing, it allows me to be out quite a bit. I'm out shooting a lot. Also, I do quite a bit of hiking and backpacking and such to just really odd places.
So let's give everybody the address again to your website. They can go look at your stuff. Of course, they can Google your name. But give us your address again for the website so people can actually go check out what you're up to.
Okay, it's boyofblue.com.
So boyofblue.com will take them right to your Boy of Blue Industries, right to your website. They can look at what you're doing, what's going on.
They can also write me on my email, which is boyofblue@yahoo.com. I also have a MySpace page, which I think is myspace.com/boyofblue, or however that works. But it's boyofblue@myspace, whatever it is. And that is a little bit easier to update new photos, like there's new photos from the HIV shoot. It was really interesting. I did an HIV photo shoot in San Francisco on this rooftop. It was for a new TV show with Dave Navarro from the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Right.
He spent the day with me working with the camera, and then we took blood right there from my buddy. And then we injected it into the solutions, and then Dave Navarro pumped it through the camera to set up the camera. And then Dave helped me set up the photo shoot and everything else. It was a pretty cool day. They had all these cameras rolling. I'm not sure when that comes out, but it was a pretty big event, and it was a lot of fun. And some of the photos from that shoot are on my MySpace page, and they came out beautiful. And I'm quite happy with the way that camera's performing lately. The latest photos from Scripts are on the MySpace page, too. Also, I did this fun photo where I had all the kids that were there watching the photo shoot come up to the glass and then put their hands and their faces against the glass of the aquarium. And I shot a photo of them from inside the aquarium. So it was kind of a fun shoot. That's also on MySpace page.
Cool stuff. Great work. Beautiful cameras. Very cool art. I mean, all the stuff you're doing, Wayne, is beautiful. And I do appreciate you spending some time with us to talk about your cameras and your art, your philosophy behind this stuff. And it's just beautiful work. And I really do appreciate it, buddy.
Hey, anytime. Hey, well, thank you very much. Like I said, for supporting film, I really appreciate it because I will always be a film guy.
Well, there you go. Wayne Martin Belger. What a great guy. Beautiful, beautiful craftsmanship, machine work, art, all the stuff combined to make this beautiful cameras, these one-off pieces of art that take photographs on film, analog photography, pinhole photography. This is great stuff that Wayne's up to. You definitely got to check out his website. The Inside Analog Photography radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful over at www.fujifilmusa.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com. DR5 over at www.dr5.com. Iger Studios over at igerstudios.com. Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. And of course, our media partners, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, over at www.apug.org. Our photography philanthropy partners, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.geh.org. I've been your host, Scott Chipper, here on Inside Analog Photography Radio. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.